from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
Starts with putting on your shoes, taking one step toward tomorrow, throwing away what you can't use. You'll never go till you move. You'll never go till you move.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Mark Curry? Y'all like Mark? More can be found out about Mark and his band on Facebook at Monk House Music. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late bluesman Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week, our writers all grapple with great expectations, whether it's of others or of themselves. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Ann Owens Wilson chances across a man who is struggling with who he thinks he should be. And we'll end the night with Richard Wheeler as the bar is set right off the bat. But let's start the night with Martin Ferguson, as he has high expectations of a man he idolized in Old Warriors.
How long will it take? My son asked as we headed north up the Central Highway. Oh, about 2 to 3 hours is all. I tried to reassure him, knowing how fidgety a 9-year-old gets on long rides. The peppering of questions continued. Who are we playing? What color is the other team's jerseys? Why aren't we just watching the game on TV? The questions continued to come fast and furious, sort of like a football-related homicide interrogation on Law & Order. I was glad to absorb the inquisition because I was taking my son to a football game. When I met my wife, I told her I don't hunt, gamble, fish, or watch NASCAR, but I do watch and go to football games. Our arrangement had now shifted to taking my son as my co-pilot on the football trips, and I was enjoying every moment of it. I looked in the rearview mirror and seeing my son playing his DS in the back, dared to interrupt his game by asking, "You remember who we're going to see?" My son never took his eyes off the game. "Yes, you've only told me 800 times. Besides going to the game, we were going to see a past All-Americans, and specifically one in particular, Randall Smiley. He'd been a living legend while I was on campus, walking like a giant among us regular students nearly 30 years ago. I had an old schedule poster kept over my desk at home, displaying Randall as a central figure on that championship team. We arrived at the stadium early and made our way to the table set up out front for the heroes from long ago. There they were, about 20 in all, sitting and autographing posters commemorating the special day. I directed my son to pick up one of the posters and meet me in the long line of fans waiting the few minutes for the aging champions from yesteryear. The line snaked past the table and was filled with guys that ranged in age from about 30 to their late 60s. The men in line matched up age-wise about the same to the ages of those autographing posters commemorating our past greatness. Some of the men in line had dragged their young sons along so they could get a look at these heroes from their youth. Most of the children seemed distracted and had started a touch football game with a small plastic football someone had brought for a signature. The main person I was looking for was just about in the middle of the group, Randall Smiley. He was still as broad as I remembered, even broader than I remembered. His sandy blonde hair now thinning as a flash of his skull showed through the open top of his visor. He wore a coach's shirt that looked like it had just been brought out of the box and put on that morning, new crease lines still showing. I waited patiently until it was almost time to come face to face with him, and I called my son over to make sure he didn't miss this Kodak moment. My son was agitated to be pulled away from the championship plastic football game. "Can we get something to eat before the game starts?" he asked me with all the patience a 9-year-old can muster. I put my hand on his shoulder, and I guided him towards the open spot that had appeared in front of Mr. Smiley. "Randall, it is great to see you again, especially back on campus," I chirped as I laid my poster out on the table for him to sign. "This is my son, and I'm raising him up to be a linebacker one day." It gets better. "Maybe his name can be with yours up there on the upper deck." I felt compelled to give Randall the details of my master plan for the boy. My son stood silent, barely interested, and Randall quickly scrawled a hardly legible signature right over his face on the poster, exactly where you want a picture autographed. Barely uttering a, "Yeah, great, thanks," he looked up, glancing over his wraparound glasses as he slid the poster back across the folding table to me, and he took out a towel and wiped the sweat from his thick neck. I shook his hand and got a feeble shake back. I thanked Randall for the signature, wished him well, and took my son's hand, leading him towards the concession stand, his preferred destination. The whole exchange had left me terribly unsatisfied and a bit agitated at the great All-American. Had I not been nice enough to him? I only told him I wanted my son to grow up and play at our alma mater so my son's name could be up there next to his for eternity. We got our food and drinks, and we made our way to our seats to settle in for kickoff. A few minutes into the first quarter, the whole row we were sitting on suddenly stood to let latecomers into the herd. To my surprise, it was Randall and his wife and two sons in tow trying to find their seats. As they took their place just a few seats down, I sat and watched, curious to see one of our greatest All-Americans actually at a ball game. I now had the chance to see how he studied the game and watched the units in detail and what analysis he would have to offer. What an opportunity. As the game started, my son was full of his usual questions, and I gladly answered them, knowing this was my opportunity to pass along my love of the game to him. There were a few chances to have this one-on-one time with him, and I intended on enjoying every moment. But I couldn't help as the game unfolded to keep an eye on our famous neighbor two seats down. What was his reaction to the crucial fumble early in the second quarter? Didn't have much of one, because he was trying to get his son's nachos picked up from underneath the seat where they just spilled. I also didn't hear a lot of in-depth analysis coming from his way. It was more of a cell phone conversation about when they were going to pick the dog up from the kennel the next day. As we got near halftime, our defense had intercepted a pass and now seemed to be returning it for a touchdown. My son jumped up in his seat, screaming as the safety crossed the goal line. He grabbed my neck. "Did you see that? That was awesome!" I gave him a shoulder hug, enjoyed the moment knowing that this is one of those memories we would talk about when I was old and gray, and he was taking his own son to a game. As the first half closed, I could hear Randall's wife ask if he had taken his diabetes medicine. He answered with an expletive and started to pull his large frame up out of the seat and head upstairs, probably for a drink to take it with. I took this moment to tell my son, "Let's hit the bathroom before the halftime crowd rushes up." We followed the behemoth up the stairs. As we got to the concourse, I watched curiously as Randall stopped in the crowd, pulled a small tin out of his pocket, one that contained his forgotten medicine. He stopped a kid with a tray of drinks to get something to wash it down with. The All-American now didn't seem to be the stuff of legend to me anymore. Up close, he'd become a reflection of myself, a mere mortal in the sea of fans on the concourse. I'd brought my son to get a look at the All-American, and what I'd got to see was another near middle-aged man dealing with everyday life as much as me. I wondered, did he have a poster from that season over his desk? Did his kids look up to him the way thousands across our state did? Or did they just think of him as dad? At that very moment, I felt my son take my hand, not something he did very often. I looked away from the All-American as we walked off and focused down at my son. He smiled and asked, "Are you glad you came today to see your dude?" I laughed at the thought of me having a dude. I stopped and leaned down. "I am glad I came today with my dude." He gave me a fist bump and asked if we could get a snow cone. We had come today to see my hero. My son had come that day just to be with his hero. Touchdown.
Martin Ferguson was born in Wynn, Arkansas. A proud graduate of Arkansas State University, he is married to a Memphis girl, Scandalous, and has a 10-year-old son that acts as his counterbalance. In our next story, Ann Owings Wilson travels across the world and meets a man who can't seem to live up to his own expectations in Amsterdam.
July 2011, Amsterdam, sixth day of a seven-day stay. I've toured the canals and visited the Van Gogh Museum, the Anne Frank House, the lovely village of Edam. Today, with little enthusiasm, I go to the red light district. My sister said I shouldn't miss it. I read the tourist brochure. It warns us that not all the girls, the prostitutes, are actually female. To be sure, we are to ask. In the event of a dispute with a prostitute or a pimp, we are to involve a police officer. We are to be explicit with the officer. He or she has heard everything and will be non-judgmental. We are to confine the use of soft drugs to the coffee houses. Families with children live in the district. We are to respect them in our behavior and speech. I am a middle-aged, middle-class woman from the middle of America. I don't intend to patronize either the coffee houses or the prostitutes. I am going only because my sister will ask. The district is grimy, smelly, sleazy, not at all like the rest of clean, shiny Amsterdam. At noon, very few girls appear in the celebrated windows, just an obese black woman and a blonde, tattooed bodybuilder. A haze of marijuana sharpens the air emitted from the famous coffee houses. The streets are closed to traffic and populated by a throng of tourists and locals. A quick walk through, and I've had enough. I find a cafe across from a canal and sit at a table outside. I order a small beer. I hear a gravelly voice from an adjoining table. "Are you from Texas?" I look to my right, a swarthy, pockmarked man in his early 40s, accompanied by a blonde young man who is barely out of his teens. "You're close," I reply, "Arkansas." I thought I recognized the accent. "What about you?" "Toronto, originally. I've been here about 10 years. "And you?" I look at Toronto's companion. "Kansas City, Missouri, not Kansas." Toronto appears relaxed, delighted with himself in Kansas City. Kansas City mimics his relaxed stance, his assurance, but I sense an underlying uncertainty. As for me, a solo traveler, I'm simply happy to have some people to chat with. "What do you do here?" I ask. "I'm a magician," says Toronto. "We're both magicians." "Not really," says Kansas City. "I can do a little. I'm learning." "He's the real magician." "I often perform in the square," says Toronto. "I give quite a show." "It's awesome," says Kansas City. I imagine a dark, devilish, muscular performance lighted by flares. I imagine Toronto eating fire and escaping from chains. Kansas City, on the edge of the crowd, is enchanted by the magic and the performer. Their eyes meet. a mutual enchantment. I bet it is, I say. I'd like to see it. A flustered middle-aged woman appears. She spots the waitress and runs up to her, gasping, "Oh, thank God." The waitress seats her, pats her on the shoulder, and brings coffee. "My daughter," the older woman says. "I had a bad feeling. I couldn't reach her on her mobile." "Yes, it's hard to be out of touch," I say. "It's just, I understand." She turns away, pulls into herself, and sits quietly for a few minutes, then leaves. I order another beer. "I'm supposed to be back at my job Monday," says Kansas City. "Maybe I'll just blow it off, though. The last guy who stayed with me came for 3 days and stayed 3 years," says Toronto, laughing. "You can't get more leave?" I ask. "It doesn't matter. I've done it before. I had this other job and went to Colorado to ski and just never went back to the job." "I see. And I broke up with my girlfriend months ago. I still see her, talk to her, but we're not together." Toronto makes a slight snorting noise. "A girlfriend? Oh, my. Could I be mistaken about their relationship?" "No, not possible. They both have the satisfied, depleted glow of the morning after the first night." "Do you go to college?" I ask. "Not now. I started last year but didn't finish the semester. I'll go back, though." "That's good," I say. "I haven't had sex since I broke up with my girlfriend," Kansas City volunteers. "It's been months, seems like years. I don't know if I'll ever have sex again." I'm startled by this unwanted revelation, but brush it off with a joke. "Keep it up and you'll be a born-again virgin." Kansas City laughs. I say to Toronto, "So will you be performing tonight in the square?" He seems distracted, surly, his gaze fixed on the canal. "Toronto," I say. "What?" he growls. "No, not tonight." He pauses and sips his coffee. His mood has darkened. "I don't just perform in the square, you know. I've toured all over the world." "Yes, of course," I say. This conversation is not fun anymore. I stand up to leave. "I've enjoyed talking to you," I say. As I walk back to the hotel, I wonder, should I have said something, done something? Kansas City might have been flinging himself upon my motherly skirts, but I'm not inclined to mother chance met acquaintances. Besides, what would I have said? "Kansas City, you're way out of your league. Go home." Surely he could figure that out for himself. The thought leaps to my mind. But what if Toronto's one of those horrible European cannibals? I have to laugh at myself. This ridiculous thought could only have arisen from my own mild anxiety at being away from familiar territory. Besides, his last boyfriend stayed 3 years. Certainly, Toronto has a powerful, dark quality, but really, he's just a man who is enjoying showing off his fresh new boyfriend on a sunny afternoon in Amsterdam. At least until the boyfriend encountered a middle-aged, middle-class, middle-American woman and remembered who he had been this time yesterday. Instead of warning Kansas City, maybe I should have said to him, "To deny love, no matter how flawed or evanescent, is terrible." I stop at a herring stand and purchase my first ever herring sandwich. It is tender and delicious.
Ann Owings Wilson publishes Arkansas Court Bulletin and plays mandolin with Arkansas Mandolin and Guitar Association. She was transplanted to the South at the age of 10 and is still unsure whether "damn Yankee" is one word or two. In our final story of the night, the expectations for Richard Wheeler begin before he has taken his first breath in Self-Esteem.
It was December the 19th, 1949, in Fayetteville, Arkansas. The United States was emerging from the big war, and prosperity was the watchword of the day. The Soviet Union got the bomb that year. The first Volkswagen Beetle was sold in the United States. South Pacific debuted on Broadway. And to cap things off, well, I was born. Our family physician, who was attending my mother during the perinatal period surrounding my birth, told my mother that he had better deliver this child, that would be me, quickly by cesarean section, because he believed the cord was wrapped around my neck and it was cutting off the oxygen to my brain. It was possible, he proclaimed, that this child, that would be me, might not be normal. To understand my story fully, one must understand my mother's personality. The simple truth is that my mother never met a disaster she didn't like. She was not a mean or spiteful person. She was quite a good mother in most ways, loving, generous to me and to my brother. Indeed, outwardly, she seemed to be a reasonably happy person. But deep inside, there was a smoldering cauldron of black, sticky badness. Truth be told, nothing made my mother happier than being miserable. She always assumed the worst in every possible situation and would worry it around in her brain until she had considered every possible thing that could go wrong. Financial disaster was a key player in many of her doomsday scenarios. My family owned a series of quite successful restaurants in Fayetteville, and we had a very comfortable middle-class life. Nevertheless, listening to my mother, one might think that every meal we ate was the last one we would be able to afford. She would hear that a customer had slipped on a wet floor, and within moments, she had conjured up images of the poor unfortunate lying in an intensive care unit, a double amputee on a ventilator, completely surrounded by a squadron of lawyers, ready to take our savings, our homes, our cars, and the clothes off our backs. This belief that we were about to be struck down with economic disaster any second led my mom to snatch up almost anything on sale, assuming that this might be her last chance while we still had money. At one point, our attic looked like a discount warehouse, with enough toilet paper to supply the state of Arkansas for months. Of course, money was only one of the many things on her never-ending list of potential disasters. If the weatherman said that there were to be snow flurries tomorrow, by the time my mother was through worrying about it and had told the story several times, people were dying in drifts higher than the tail end of a tall giraffe. We would all starve because the stores would run out of food and gas stations would bear the brunt of wandering mobs looking for and stealing the last few drops of gasoline. It would be a miracle if anyone survived. Now, the fact that these horrible outcomes never actually happened didn't dissuade her one bit. She would just shrug and move on to the next pending catastrophe. So, on that cold winter day in 1949, just think what Mom did with the news of the cord wrapped around my neck. Possibly choking off the oxygen to my brain. Her mind began to churn. Her imagination went into overdrive. And by the time I was finally brought into this world, she considered it simply a miracle that I even resembled a human infant. Now, seeing how the job of a newborn for the first several months is simply to drool, it was hard for her to judge at first just how much I had been affected by this umbilical cord strangulation I had suffered. However, as I approached each developmental milestone with morbid fascination, she assumed the worst. Was I ever going to be able to turn myself? Would I crawl, walk, or do any of the things that normal children did? Mom was sure that this was the milestone that I would not accomplish. And when I did accomplish it, she was convinced that it was the last one I would conquer. This followed me throughout my life. Every time I would do something good, Mom would be proud of me, and she would tell me so. But every time, the acknowledgement would be accompanied by a phrase which I grew to dread. A phrase which was delivered with no malice or evil intent, just a natural result of my mother's basic personality. When I graduated from medical school, Mom told me that she was proud of me and that I had done a good thing. "Congratulations, son. I am so proud of you. You have accomplished so much." But then I would wait. I would wait for the ego-chilling, self-esteem-stomping phrase which I had come to expect. "Congratulations, son. I am so proud of you. You have accomplished so much. Just think what you could have done if you hadn't been brain damaged at birth." I am convinced that I could have created life in a test tube, discovered intelligent life on another planet, solved the problem of cold fusion in my kitchen, or perhaps even discovered a Higgs boson in my bathtub. And the response would have been the same. "Congratulations, son. I am so proud of you. You have accomplished so much. Just think what you could have done if you hadn't been brain damaged at birth."
In spite of his birth trauma, Richard Wheeler became a physician and has served as the Executive Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the University of Arkansas College of Medicine for 25 years. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website, and we are open for submissions from Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.